Like, I mean, my cat's, she's okay normally, but like every once in a while, it's like, yeah, you'll like, you bring something new into the house and she's just like, whoa, what's that? I don't like that at all, And just, or there's like certain noises. Like when we run the garbage disposal, like she's just like, what did you just do? Like,
Well, I think also like cats are very, very sensitive. And I think their reaction in fear is just so extreme and so funny. Like they will either like get really, really puffy, or they will like bolt in like a really comedic way. So I'm not surprised. Whereas a dog, I think they just bark at it, right?
I think dogs are much more in like in tune with like how are you reacting to a thing, and that's gonna give them clues about how they should react.
Or just, I don't know, or dogs pick up on whatever you're putting out there,
Like a cat, if something is scary to a cat, they don't care about you at that point. They're just like,
Well,
I
that's
gotta
not
run away.
true.
No, but I mean like they're not looking to you for how you're reacting to judge how they should react, I don't think.
I disagree. So I specialize in afraid cats. I specialize
Fair.
in behavioral messes. And they absolutely do. So like I have a routine where it's like whenever there's something loud outside, I say noise outside, and it's like it's okay, noise all done, it's all right. So they definitely do take cues from you. Even if they do it in like a side eye kind of subtle way. They're like, oh, freaking out? I don't know. Speaking of pets that are sometimes invisible.
Welcome to the Trade Readers. We are reading a book called My Aunt is a Monster by Raymina Yee. I am not 100% sure I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but I hope I am. And this is not a major plot point, but there is a creature, a pet that you never see until later, and then you do see them. Before we talk about the book, we should do a character building question. So I have a bit of a different one this time. So my character building question for all of you is, if you had a nickname based on a food that you eat a lot of, what would it
Well, I'm jam.
Are you named after the food?
Indirectly.
Indirectly, okay. Because I wasn't 100. That's I was when I was coming up with this question. I'm like, okay, Jam is either going to have a really simple answer or a more complicated one.
Well, I often come in purple. I'm very sweet, and I'm constantly getting myself into sticky situations. But no, I was not named for excessive consumption of the food. It's not even one of my favorites. I do eat jam, but yeah, sorry. I guess that's my answer.
That's a
That's
good answer.
the only nickname I have these days.
I mean, you led in strong there with the comparisons. I was like, oh man, like you got a whole rationale for the nickname. It fits in with the food type. I mean, I'm still racking my brain. I'm like, what do I consume regularly that I would even be nicknamed for? I mean, like now I'm trying to think of a coffee pun nickname because I feel like that's my consistent staple. It's like coffee beans.
Yeah, well, that was going to be mine too. I'm JD, and the only one I can think of that makes any kind of sense is like, what do I order when I go to Starbucks? So it would be like a caramel macchiato, but like, I don't know what that says about me. Like, I don't feel very attached to that as a label. That's just a thing I like to eat.
Caramel macchiato energy.
Like, what is that? That's very unclear. Like a pumpkin spice latte, like there's a vibe attached to that, but not so much with the caramel macchiato.
There's a vibe, but I think it's a hard one to put a pin in.
Maybe that makes it the right one then.
I mean, if you want to build off like coffee as a personality trait, I mean, I usually would get like an Americano, and then I discovered Americano Misto, where you just add a little bit of steamed milk. And it's like I always add milk to my Americano anyways. So I'm always just like, because they don't have it on the menu normally. So you're just like, oh, I'll have an Americano. Oh, can I get that Misto? And then in a good cafe, they're just like, oh, of course. And then like, I've never really had them not be like understanding. But anyways, I don't know. That's my, I always get an Americano Misto. In fact, sometimes when I'm getting like a faint, if I'm at, someone's treating me to a coffee, I need to remind myself, like, well, maybe I should actually get something fancy instead of just basically like an extremely fancy coffee with milk in it.
There
Like
are
the.
so many ways to enjoy coffee. It's wonderful. I have a reputation at work, probably. I've had enough people comment on it, that I bring my own beans despite coffee being supplied at work. And it's
Oh.
because I drink my coffee black. And the beans that they
Oh.
have are too acidic.
See,
Hurts my tummy. So I have to bring my
I
own.
bring my own coffee to work, but that's because work does not provide coffee.
Ooh.
We have a budget, you see.
Ugh.
I mean, this is, man, one of the new schools I'm at, that's like the big luxury is like they always have the like bags of coffee and the coffee urn. And like the new thing I've learned is like I come in at noon, I'll like make a fresh pot of coffee, and like multiple people walk in the staff room and are like, oh, someone made fresh coffee? Oh man, oh, amazing.
Yeah, I gotta say, no slag on work. Like there was no coffee for a little while during the building construction, and there was almost a riot. And because there was a
That's how you
German,
get coffee. That
yeah,
was a
well,
good thing to do.
and furthermore, like because we're a German company, there's not only coffee, there's a bubble water dispensing machine. It's like bubble water on demand because we're a German company and the Germans who visit us would not tolerate it otherwise.
Okay, so I should probably tell you a little bit about our cartoonist today.
You don't want to keep
So,
coffee talk?
what's that?
I say you don't want to keep going with coffee talk.
Coffee talk is great, but we're not a coffee podcast.
All
Just, it's not, it's the trade
right.
waiters, not the brew waiters. I don't know. Okay, so Romina Yee is from Malaysia. She lives in Australia at the moment. She's done a few books. I haven't read all of them, but after reading a couple of them, I want to read more. She did one called The Carpet Merchant of Constania and another one called Seance Tea Party. And the other one that I have read is her retelling of the sort of the legends around Alexander the Great. It's called Alexander, the Servant and the Water of Life. She's also the one of the founders of the Cartoonist Co-op, which we've talked about on the show before, and is and we also talked about another project of hers, which is the Creator's Guide of Comics Devices, which I'll have to put a link in the show notes because it's super useful and super interesting. She's basically collected like the different sort of tools cartoonists use for transitions or for like page composition or panel composition, and put them all in one place, labeled as many of them as have labels. And it's a really interesting sort of curatorial project to sort of study the medium that like is on par with anything that Scott McCloud has done, I think. It's a that level of importance to understanding comics, I think. And yeah, so that's our cartoonist. What did you think of this book?
I have beef with Kobo to start. So, this
Uh-oh.
is not the fault of Romina. This is not the fault of her publisher, but do not buy the Kobo edition of this book. It is messed up.
Oh.
So, I was very excited that there was a Kobo edition because, again, don't have to go to Amazon. Hooray!
Yeah,
And it
I
worked
did
fine for
check,
roaming.
but I didn't download it.
Oh my God. So, you open it up in the browser view. And half of the pages are missing. Each
What?
right-hand page of the two-page spread is blank. And it's not a problem with the file. And so if you open it on your phone, you can see both pages of the two-page spread. It's fine. Unfortunately, on your phone, it also enforces full spread view, which is too small for me. Too small for me and my little eyes, you know, like both pages vertically, like you can't, not horizontally. A two-page spread. So I thought, okay, I have Samsung DeX. I'll just use my phone to put it on the computer, which I did, and it was working fine until I rotated my phone and asked it to go a little bigger, and then the Kobo app crashed. I'm like, that's fine. I'm going to go into the Windows Store and get the Kobo app on the Windows Store. And first of all, there's one that you need to pay for. That's fake. Don't buy that one. But if you go into
Oh
the
no.
other app and try to load it, it has the same problem. It crashes. So finally, after like a long time, I used Windows Connect phone to mobile, got it up on my screen, and like dragged it out as far as I could. And it was very low res. And it was a very, very unenjoyable way to experience this book and the beautiful art in it. So do not buy the Kobo edition of this
Oh
book.
man,
It was a
that's
nightmare.
terrible. Like, I
That
don't
was
know.
so
Why is it so
bad.
difficult to just like export PDF, sell PDF?
Because
Why can't
DRM,
people do
man.
that?
Well, that's interesting because like I picked mine up on the Kindle edition just because I have most of my books now. I mean, I know it's bad. I should switch over to Kobo, but most of my books are on Kindle from Comixology, so I've just been continuing that with that infrastructure.
You're
So I
not
got the.
responsible for Amazon being
Oh, I
MFA.
know. Yeah. So anyway, so I got the Kindle edition. It worked fine. I read it on my iPad. It didn't force me into spreads, but I was actually going to mention that page 136 and 137 were reversed. So I was reading and I was like, wait, this seems odd. And then I like read the next page. I'm like, oh, this page was supposed to come before this page. So like the pages were out of order in the Kindle edition. Only once, but
That's
still.
weird. Yeah, I put this 100% down to the Kobo app, which has always been a bit jank, to be fair. So it's definitely a Kobo problem and not, but it seems like the ebook edition of this is a little bit cursed.
Page out of order aside, and though I think I actually noticed a few typos as well, but putting that aside, I enjoyed reading this book and I liked the art. And in fact, building off a little bit from last episode when I was raving about the storytelling, I really liked Romina's approach to illustrating this story. And the style is very simple, but there's lots of layouts that make me think of Will Eisner's The Spirit, where there's like no panel borders and the art kind of flows from one scene into the next on a full page without any dividing lines, but it does it in a very successful way. So yeah, I think it was a very, very, again, another very comfortable cartoonist using their medium very effectively in the storytelling of this work.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Romina, so I was excited to get a chance to read this book, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun. I really enjoyed the plot. The art is gorgeous. I love the way she draws, and it was really fun. There were some surprising things to me. So at the beginning, like the main character is blind, which I thought was very well handled and very interesting, and I'd like to talk about that more. But at first, I couldn't tell if the ant was literally or metaphorically a monster. And I thought, like, well, the character is blind. And so someone said that she's a monster. So maybe she's just imagining her as a monster and not. And so I thought it was a more metaphorical. But later on, it's revealed that it's like, no, it's very, very literal.
That's
And actually, it's
interesting.
this character who's the main character has been kept in the dark about it and feels betrayed. So I thought that was interesting. What about
Yeah,
you?
like I think the reason I picked this book, the reason I like it so much is that it's just so much unlike any other graphic novel that I've read, except for like her other work, of course. Like the art style is very unique. The approach to like laying out a page is very unique. Even the plot is like it doesn't save any cats. It doesn't like do like three acts or anything like that. It does its own thing. And it's like, that's what I want out of a comic, because I don't want to know how it's going to end when I read page five. I want to be able to sort of experience it and go with the characters on this journey. And a big part of that is like it being an unconventional story structure. The art actually reminds me of like cartoons from the 1950s. Like, I don't know if there's a name for that style of animation, but like this sort of like quick gestural or seemingly very simple gestural drawing, but
I think what you
it's.
mean, like a simplified style, not quite Hanna-Barbera, but like 1950s advertising style, maybe.
Yeah. I think there were a lot of illustrators who were working in a style like that at the time, where it's like just very simple, bold shapes. It looks like you drew it all in one go, but like there's a level of skill needed to be able to like draw such a complicated thing without lifting your pencil or whatever. And yeah, it's very graphic. It sort of plays with the idea of like these are two-dimensional images depicting three-dimensional events. And I really like that. It feels very sort of like I spend a lot of time learning art history in university, and there's this a lot of like historical art is very sort of playing in that like we haven't yet invented like perspective lines, and so we're just like figuring out a way to portray three-dimensional space. And it's like it's really interesting to sort of like bring that back and say, oh, like yeah, we know how to do perspective lines, but like it's still just a two-dimensional page. Don't forget that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. One like little, I don't know, I'm gonna call it a nitpick, I guess, that I'm curious both of your thoughts on is something that I did notice kind of going through the work, especially flipping through it a second time, was the ant as a monster has a very detailed like face, and sometimes the feels a little bit almost like Disney-esque with like the way that she's drawn, and yet the other characters are much more flat and simplified. And I felt like sometimes maybe this was an intent, which but I just felt like the ant sometimes felt like drawn in a way slightly different than the other characters, like maybe just in terms of like the amount of detail.
I think that the design of the ant didn't lend itself as well to Raimina's skill with simplification. Let's put
Maybe
it that
that's it.
way. Like a human face is very detailed, but it can be abstracted away a lot of it. And I think there were so many design elements that were chosen to be as part of the monster design, the ant monster design that couldn't be abstracted as cleanly. And maybe like no, they were being abstracted just fine, but it led to this disparity of level of detail, which I think is what you're picking up on.
Yeah, like I feel like maybe that's the result of like we know what a human face looks like. And so you can simplify it more without losing that like instant recognition. Whereas where you have like a weird creature, you don't have that kind of instant connection. And so you're kind of drawing more detail just to other it, to make it a more of a thing you're looking at than a thing you're looking through.
Yeah. Like, and I don't think it hurt the story, but it was just something that I kind of noticed as I was going through where I was just like, yeah, like the ant almost feels like a character from another comic visiting this comic, you know?
Yeah, it could be. Overall, though, I would say I really liked the monster design of the ant. Like, I loved the scaly neck, and I feel like she was still drawn super elegantly. Like she always felt very elegant and had like a very strong presence, even though she felt very other, because of her monster characteristics.
Yeah, and a very emotive face too, like with a complicated creature face, it could be pretty easy to sort of lose the ability to show emotions on that face, and we don't lose that. I think that's kind of maybe what makes it reminiscent of a Disney character is that her face is so emotive.
Yeah, maybe because like the mouth is so wide and it's kind of jaw construction that it feels bigger and like goes through more transitions, maybe.
Yeah, like whether it's like inspired by a Disney style or not, I think it has at least hit on some of the same tools that a Disney animator would use to sort of have a strange creature face that can emote.
Yeah.
I mean, should I give like a little Just a quick summary of the story.
Sure.
Okay, so the main character is Safia. She is we're never really given any kind of indication of where most things in this story happen. It's like made up countries basically. But her parents own a bookstore. The bookstore burns down. Her parents don't survive, so she's all on her own. She gets adopted out to an aunt that she's never met. The aunt used to be the world's greatest explorer or adventurer. I forget the exact phrase that they use, but has been out of the public eye, apparently dead, as far as anyone knows, for 8 years. Her aunt is a monster, but Safia doesn't know that because Safia is blind. And the aunt has an ongoing rivalry with a childhood friend of hers who she calls Pineapple Tart. And Pineapple Tart has rediscovered the lost city that Aunt Whimsy had, what was her last discovery, the one that ended up with her turned into a monster. And she needs to save her rival from a similar fate, but also make sure that she doesn't get the credit for her discovery. And so they go on a trip, the first trip that Aunt Whimsy has been on since her disappearance, and the first trip that Safia has ever been on, because she's lived a something of a closed off life. And along the way, Safia makes friends with a girl named Hebe, I'm guessing at the pronunciation. And turns out that Hebe is working for this other dastardly organization that is trying to steal. Basically, they're trying to create chaos, and their plan for creating chaos is to kidnap Pineapple Tart and use them to find this lost city, and then unspecified after that. So
I think
they.
sell the artifacts to art dealers for profit.
Oh, that's right. That's what it is. That's yeah. And to sell it to rich people so they can like put it in glass cases. And so this is obviously a difficulty for this friendship between Safia and Hebe, because like Hebe is essentially betraying her, and then Safia also feels betrayed by her aunt when she finds out she's actually a monster and hasn't told her all this time. And they eventually make their way to the city, and the thing with the monster is that Aunt Whimsy has been turned into this monster that is supposed to be the protector of this city. And not just the protector of the lost city, but the protector of the descendants of the people who live there. So they successfully protect the city and rescue Pineapple Tart, and the artifacts don't get stolen, and everything kind of turns out. I mean, there's a lot going on, but that's kind of the gist of it.
Yeah, I also felt like this was setting up for a longer series.
I don't know. Like I think it's the kind of thing that definitely there could be a sequel. I don't know if any sequel has ever been planned or will ever be planned, but yeah, you're right. It shares that with I think a lot of YA graphic novels where like this could be a series, you know, if publisher says, "Hey, we want another one."
Yeah, but it felt satisfying on its own. It
Oh
had
yeah.
like a fable
Oh.
vibe to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the where it ended, but I definitely felt like there was a lot of potential in the air. Like there still felt like there was a lot of, not like, I don't know, maybe, well, like I mean, things with Hebe felt a little bit unresolved, but I mean, they sort of teased out like the aunt, you know, she's got a human hand now. And so there's like this potential that maybe she could turn herself back into a human. And I don't know. I just felt like there was still like a lot of fertile soil for like more story. So I'm actually kind of surprised to hear that there isn't like a part two or a part two in the works.
I mean, not as
Yeah.
far as I know. I don't know.
Well, that is interesting. I expected the ant to fully transform after
Yeah.
the emerald was destroyed, but it seems to have been some kind of exchange because the ant's hand is fine, but Hebe's hand is now monstrous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. Like I was also expecting, like that's part of what I like about this is how it doesn't do the expected thing. I like that she stays as this monster and not just stays as this monster, but understands I think that her being a monster gives her a job. Like, she is now beloved by the people of this village who she has protected by being the sort of the guardian of their city.
Yeah, and I feel like there's a metaphor in there, like the blindness. So I mentioned this before, but like I really like the way that this character's blindness was handled, in that it was intrinsic to the character. It wasn't, what how can I put this? A lot of disability narratives center on the quote unquote tragedy of their disability, and this never felt like Safi's blindness was a tragedy. And a lot of disability narratives, I feel, as well, would end with, oh, and your blindness is cured, you know? Like, I didn't expect Romina to go that way personally, like, but I've seen that in a lot of narratives, and I'm very glad that it didn't end up this way. And especially the way that at the beginning, where the aunt describes her condition as a disfigurement. And it's really interesting to put the two of them together, because Safia comes into this and she does not seem to have any baggage about her blindness. She adapts the world to her own needs. She really loves audio. She explores things in her own way. She's very charismatic and friendly and loves to explore. She doesn't feel held back by her disability, and she's like sad that she's too young and can't go out to explore the world yet, but it's something she very much wants to do. Whereas her aunt needs that time to come to the acceptance of her condition. She was born a different way and has lost something. So she feels like a loss of being able to go into the world without being noticed, without being stared at for looking different. And it's only at the end does she feel confident enough to go out into the world as herself. So I thought that was
Yeah,
interesting.
that's really interesting. Like, I think I agree with, I mean, obviously I don't have a disability, so it's hard to sort of say for sure this is 100% like the right way to do it or anything like that, but it sure felt like this was a very loving portrayal of a character. And I like that even though she feels the sort of self-confidence that she's able to be an adventurer despite being blind, that it's not going to be a barrier. We're also like shown the things that she can't do. Like, she has ways around them. Like, she can't, her parents owned a bookstore and she couldn't read any of the books. But that wasn't a problem because her parents read to her or she did audiobooks. Or like, she's going on an adventure. She can't probably do this by herself, not just because she's a kid, but also because like, it's going to be hard to move through the world, but that doesn't mean she can't go. And like, when she's on this adventure, like, she's looking forward to being able to sort of like feel the wind on her face, or like touch all the artifacts that they're going to find. Or she's not sad that she can't see the things. She's looking forward to the ways that she can experience it without the story pretending that, oh, it's exactly the same. There's no difference between her
Yeah.
and someone else.
And I really, really liked the way that it led it felt, as I mentioned earlier, intrinsic to the to this character, but also intrinsic to like the conflict between her and her aunt, because it was like such an interesting tension there, where her aunt lied to her by minimizing the fact that she called herself disfigured, but did not specify that she's like actually completely inhuman and a dragon person now. And she could only get away with that because Safia was blind. And so Safia felt very betrayed. She's like, you thought you could get away with this, and you didn't tell me because I'm blind, you know, because I can't see it, you know? And it's a, I thought that was a very, that was a real core way to tie who Safia is to how she experienced this betrayal.
Yeah, and the fact that it's pretty bold-facedly a betrayal. Like, Hebe does something similar where she's like rifling through their cabin while Safi is not looking. And like, this is and the story doesn't just like gloss over that. Like, this is part of Hebe betraying her friendship. And so like, it tying those two things together, even without necessarily spelling it out, like, you betrayed me by going through my stuff. Like, no, it's you can piece it together as the reader.
Yeah, no, it was Yeah, I think it was a good representation of a disability in a story. And it was nice also that, again, like the characters didn't, like it wasn't something that kept getting revisited. Like, I don't know, again, I feel like in worse approaches to the writing, like other characters would be commenting on this. Like it would be this sort of thing that keeps getting brought up where, like, you know, Hebe meets Safiya and just like, you know, just like, oh, you're blind. Okay. Like moving on, like just takes it at face value and like moves forward. There isn't this like, oh, that must be so hard for you kind of dialogue, you know, like,
Or how do you do this? How do you do this?
Oh, yeah. Does this mean your hearing's super sensitive? Anyways,
Like, how do you get to be an adventurer if you can't see anything?
And,
you know, despite the betrayal at the end, I thought it was very sweet that, you know, Hebe sent, mailed Safiya an audio cassette player with a message in it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
with like
Like
a
everything fully
tactile buttons
contained.
on it.
Yeah.
Like, where do you even find one of those? Like, those seem super useful.
Yeah, it looked like a really sick device. I liked it.
You get a lot of good extra swag when you work at the Bureau of Suspicious Intent, which I will say,
I really like all the like sort of
yes.
fake agencies and stuff.
I think all the agencies felt like what if you asked a little kid to like name an agency, and then it's just like in this world, it's okay. Like everyone's agency is named after named by an 8-year-old, and it's okay. We're just gonna go with it, and we're not gonna like question it. It's great. I mean, because it just felt like it's. I mean, like I enjoyed this, but it did feel like it was like primarily for young readers. And I think having stuff like the Bureau of Suspicious Intent is just such a, like, that's just the right sweet spot for like a young reader, you know, to have like weird organizations with names like that, you know.
Yeah, that and the like the magazine that Aunt Whimsy was the editor of, a lot of like the weird conspiracy things that this magazine writes articles about, like a lot of them are either real things or at least real conspiracy theories, which I bet a young reader is really gonna get a lot out of that. Like, oh, I recognize that reference. Like that's like I would love that. Or I would have loved that when I was a kid, like being able to
Yeah.
get those references.
I think I would have really loved this as a kid as well, just like kind of the spirit of adventure and like going to explore and all these different people. It looks it's a really fun book.
Yeah, it's got kind of a, yeah, it's got a little bit of like an Indiana Jones vibe, like you're going to all these foreign lands in search of like the, you know, the magic MacGuffin, like
And
I
yet
don't know.
manages to not be even a little bit colonialist.
Right.
Like that's not a small feat. I think that we need to acknowledge, like, yes, you can do like an Indiana Jones type story without having the Indiana Jones character who like robs villagers of their priceless artifacts and shoves them in the British Museum.
And those people are the bad guys. That's what.
And it can be just as much fun.
So, with the pineapple tart, which now I know she has a real name, but I just think of her as Pineapple Tart.
Oh, right?
Them.
Professor Choi?
Yes, it's I wrote it down. Professor Dr. Cecilia Choi. Yes.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah,
And I went and screwed this up myself because like I was trying to comment on the fact that Pineapple Tart, I noticed the characters constantly saying they them. So I was like, I think this is a non-binary character, but it's not implicitly being stated. And then in one of the news articles, they use she, but then
Oh,
the
did they?
characters are intimately that no, the characters seem to use they. And so I'm like, I think this is a non-binary character, but also like there was a little inconsistency. And so I was like, is there maybe like, was that just something that mi they missed in editing, or is that also intentional that like the newspapers misgendering?
I bet it's the newspaper misgendering them then.
And then
That makes a lot of
I
sense.
went and misgendered them when I brought it up. But anyway,
Oh well. Yeah, I really like that this is a character who like is just has they them pronouns, and it's never we don't spend an extra 5 pages explaining this to readers. 'Cause like at this point, like the kid who's reading this book isn't gonna need that 5-page explanation. They've heard of this already.
It gets about as much explanation as the invisible dog.
Yeah. Which seems fair.
Which is fair. Yeah.
There's
It's like it's
invisible
a world
dogs.
with non-binary people and invisible dogs. Well, okay.
Yeah.
Like the invisible dog. I like
Yeah,
that
I
it
like
came
when we
along.
finally. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just love that it came along and like the big reveal at the end where it's like, oh, none of us knew the dog actually tagged along because it's invisible. Well, really.
Yeah,
How did you guys
and even Safiya knows that no one knows what the dog looks like.
I
And
love
then,
that.
like, I really like the design of the dog when we finally see it.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah, the
just this
dog's kind of cute.
weird, vaguely dog-shaped thing.
It's so cute. It's like a dog in a ghillie suit.
I just also like, I mean, this is consistent throughout Romina's work, but I just love the design of the pages. Like there's I think she's kind of not going full tilt with interesting panel transitions in this book, maybe because it's for younger readers, but there is, we do get a little bit of that. Like the collages and the some panels not having boundaries, and yeah, it's just, this is someone who's obviously spent a lot of time thinking about, like, how do you put panels on a page, and what does it mean when you do it this way versus this way?
Yeah, I
Yeah.
wonder if she had to restrain herself because it's something she's so adept at and like clearly enjoys a lot of playing with paneling and playing with comic structure.
Yeah, I that's the impression that I get. Because I also just finished reading her Alexander book, and there's a lot more of that sort of like interesting page layouts. But yeah, I mean, you're writing a book for readers who haven't been reading comics that long yet. And so there's only so much you can get away with doing. You need things that will be intuitive enough that they won't get lost.
Yeah.
And I think she puts a lot of faith in her readers for what she does try to do. Like there are all these like obviously this is a podcast. Now I'm doing the thing that I always criticize people for, like showing you panels on a podcast that no one can see. But we've got these like scenes where it's like a collage of images, and where you're just supposed to understand that these are separate events that have all happened throughout the day. And yeah, I don't think readers are going to get lost by that. I think they're going to be fine.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting because, like, again, I feel like this is like a callback to roaming, where like it's the same kind of idea of these big collage panels to like express multiple events spread over time. It's like a montage, right? A montage of Safiya and Hebe's friendship, you know, and their adventures on the ship. It's like instead of doing one singular activity, it's like here's just a smattering of all these different things they do on the cruise ship. And yeah, I mean, again, it's like the film equivalent would be a montage and like it's a visual montage, but I think that it's not so complicated that your readers aren't gonna pick up on it. Also, I don't know, maybe this is like a good sign of where the kids are at, because I feel like kids have been exposed to a lot more comics these days. So I think you kids are a little more comic savvy than they were in my day.
Oh, for sure.
You
Absolutely. Yeah.
get away with a little more. Now take a few more chances with your YA comic these days.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
exciting.
Like the most challenging panel layout that I was reading as a kid was Garfield, and like there's no challenge there. They're all in a row. You don't
Oh,
even
one,
have to like
two,
return to the
three.
next line.
Oh my God. You read Calvin and Hobbes. Come on.
Okay, all right. Calvin and Hobbes, you have to at least do the like return to the next line at the end of the line.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I think like I read Asterix, which is probably the most challenging until I got into manga. But even that, like when I think about it, I can't say for sure whether like 100% of the pages are like this, but my memory of it is that like everything had a very clear boundary. You know, it was panel, 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 panel. I can't remember a lot of breakage of that structure, not like manga.
And if it did, it was unnoticeable because it was like clear to you as a reader.
Yeah, there may have been like an action scene or like a chase scene or something, but I remember like very clearly starting to read Ranma, right? And Takahashi-sama has like this habit of putting a full body like portrait of a new character as they're being introduced, like across all the panels. I remember being like so affected by that because I thought it was so cool, which just speaks to like how different it was in my readership at that point.
Yeah, like I
Reader experience.
talking around about the wrong book on the wrong episode now, but there was some of that in Roaming, and it's like, yeah, I should do that more of that in my work. It's just such a good way to introduce a character.
Yeah. I think that was the biggest, I don't know, again, like mind blown for me in making comics was when someone pointed out, like, oh, you don't have to put a frame around everything. And like you start to look at, and again, I go back to Will Eisner. It's like you look at the way he would just like, I mean, the spirit was in a grid at the start, but like by the end of his career, like he would go pages and pages, and you would be lucky to have like a single panel like tucked into one corner of the page. Everything was just flowing, right? Characters flowing through scenes, and you could still follow the narrative, right? And I know, I think that that comes with experience and with confidence as a cartoonist.
And faith in your readers too. Like that's got to be part of it.
There was one. Okay, this is a weird one though. I made a little note to myself. So on page 166, Hebe's like hanging out on the deck of the ship, and then her cousins come by from the like Bureau of Malicious Intent or whatever, and she's got this like coconut drink, and then she's drinking out of a straw, but when they come and disturb her, suddenly there's like this weird Y-shaped double straw that like
Yeah.
one of them's drinking out of, and then
They brought their own double straw.
yes, but this is like, it's sort of like this weird Y-shaped straw seems to show up out of nowhere, and then
I think that's the only possible explanation because it's
they
not
take
there in the
turns
panel
stealing.
before.
They take turns stealing from her drink, and like I don't know, it's just like it's a weird thing, but I was like, but really, they could have all just been using the same straw. It would have been fine. Like,
That's
because
not
at no
COVID
point do
safe.
you have two people drinking out of the drink at the same time.
That's some waste
I
activity.
So
I know
I was
you're super pedantic, but.
curious about the characters' names, so I had to look up because they sound Greek.
Yeah,
So I
I
looked
thought
them up.
they sounded Greekish, so I'm curious to know what you found.
So Dolos and Apate are the cousins. Those are the god and goddess of deceit.
Oh.
Which is appropriate. And then Hebe says what her name means. It's like the goddess of youth or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I
Yeah.
remember her saying that.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I like that this is set in a world where I mean, we see a world map and it's a recognizable world map, but there's no country borders on it. So the countries are imaginary. That's a very sort of like early 20th century comics thing to do, which I always enjoy when it happens. But it's still like close enough to the real world that obviously they know about Greek mythology and they have a lot of the same references that we have. It's a fun space to play in. It helps you sort of deal with the fact that we're going to have like a made up lost city that we don't have in the real world, which is an unavoidable thing because you're going to have the city revealed in the story, and obviously that didn't happen in real life. So
Yeah.
I don't know, it's fun.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was fun. I liked the sense of place still felt authentic. Like it's giving South Asia, right? Like it has a South Asia vibe, but in a non-specific way. But I still really appreciated the multiculturalism, the casual multiculturalism. Like I don't think that's the right way to put it, but there was so many different people coming from different places, and there's like a melding of culture that you would very naturally find in Southeast Asia. And I really liked the way that made it to the page.
Yeah, like the country of they do have a passport at one point. So the place that Safia is from is it's called Bracknell, And based
Okay.
on just looking at their passport, it gives off like former British colony vibes.
Okay.
So maybe a stand-in for Malaysia, but it doesn't need to be spelled out. It does it's
No.
that's not important.
I also just liked how in the backgrounds of all the different scenes, it was kind of casually multicultural, right? Like
Yeah.
it's always like people like there was a Sikh in the background on the ship. Like there's people of different, all kinds of different skin colors and ethnic costuming. Like it's a very international world that they're in, right?
Yeah,
Like
like different names from different languages. Like it's fully fleshed out. It's not just we're gonna make up countries and then make up ethnicities to go with them. It's like these are recognizable. It's just in a different arrangement.
Yeah, I liked it. It kind of like it gives me I'm gonna say Steven Universe vibes, but stick with me because Steven Universe is in like an alternate America where Steven Universe has this like very clear Americana vibe, but all the states are just kind of like weird, like vaguely different. And this kind of felt geographic narratively equivalent to that. Where it's like everything is still vaguely in the same place with the same kind of people, but the borders are just kind of vaguely different.
Yeah, and we don't get to see those borders, so you're gonna have to
No,
make it up.
and it's not important. All
Yeah.
you need to know is that it's an Earth AU.
Yeah. Earth AU, somewhere vaguely South Asia-ish.
Yeah,
Probably.
probably. And it was fun. I loved that setting. I loved it. I thought it had so much texture and color, and it brought so much to the narrative. Like, it brought so much to the vibe of the story. I loved where it was set.
Speaking of color, I also want to shout out how well this is colored. I love these
So
colors.
beautiful. Oh.
It's like I think the simplest way to do a good color take on a comic is to have a few number of colors, like a small palette, and just use those colors. And then it's hard to go wrong. But like this has a very broad palette of colors, and it still uses them like so effectively. Like it's got these like everything is really bright for most of the comic and like rich and like saturated, but not in a way where the colors are kind of like competing with each other. Like it's really well done.
Yeah, I thought the coloring was really beautiful. It stood out to me so many times where I'm like, oh, I just love the choices here. I love the choice of color and I love the way that it's applied. And it like the flat style lends itself so well to the way that the line art is, I
Oh,
feel.
yeah.
Because I think if there was a lot of rendering on it would look strange.
Yeah, like imagine these lines with the same coloring from what was the Superman book we
Oh
did?
man, with like
Photoshop,
quietly.
gradients.
Oh my God, gradient all the things, you know, where you like where you lasso like the muscle on the bicep and put another gradient on that.
That would be so inappropriate for this drawing.
So I'm sure it's not a thought that crossed anyone's
Mean,
mind, but just to emphasize how good and proper this looks.
yeah. Where would you even put a gradient on this work?
There
Like
are some gradients. They're
yeah, I'm
very,
sure, like certain sunsets
very,
and things like
yeah.
that.
Like there's,
Sorry, like what I meant was just like, you know, the drawing style itself, I think, lends itself to the more flat coloring. Cause I think if you started doing those like gradients on gradients, you'd just be like horrifically altering the art in a way that would be for the worse, you
yeah,
know?
it would be a betrayal of the two-dimensionalness of the design.
Yeah, I mean, like it's so true that comics just don't feel complete without a big Photoshop lens flare. And yet, somehow, this
Like
comic felt like it was doing okay without it.
okay, so there's
And
okay, what's her name? I just said it. Apate. Apate has this dress that's like it's a white to cyan gradient, but because it's the only thing in the scene that even has a
oh, yeah.
gradient, it stands out as really special. Like this is a really fancy dress because it's the only thing on the entire page with a gradient in it.
Yeah. Okay.
That's how
Yeah.
you use a gradient, everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But the color choice was awesome. Everything felt super harmonious. It felt like it flowed. It felt like the choices, I think you described it as bright earlier, JD, where
like saturated.
it gave it a levity that it that belongs in this in the narrative, right? I felt like the color choices matched the narrative in terms of levity and brightness and kind of fairy tale-ness. So it was really nice. And you could contrast it with Alexander as well. I feel like Alexander's color choices are a lot heavier and more saturated even, but like in a deeper value, perhaps.
Yeah, like I happen to have it right here. Like I'm kind of thinking we should pick this Alexander book as a future Trade Waiters episode when the next volume comes out or something, because like it's
Ooh,
so
yeah.
good.
It's really
But
good.
yeah,
I
the
really enjoyed
colors
it.
are very different, like very different choices in terms of like the palette that she's using, because it's a different story.
Yeah. And that's, I think that sounds very obvious, but I think it's not obvious enough to the community, maybe. I think it's starting to get more obvious where people are like, oh no, coloring is its own narrative choice. Whereas like we were talking about the gradients because it felt like there was a moment in like the mid-90s where every single superhero comic had that gradient over gradient style.
Yeah, it's because gradients had just been invented.
Yes, right, because Photoshop was the new hotness
Yeah.
and everyone had to use all the tools.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, this is like a tangent, but like I was talking, someone was musing about all the like grimdark violence and sex and like 90s comics and like why that was. And I was like, well, like the comics code was just disappearing. And so like people were like embracing all of this adult content that they couldn't have written before. And it was the same as like when computer coloring first emerged. It's just like everyone just felt compelled to use every tool in the toolkit. And then later they were like, wait, what if we only use this a little bit with some discretion? And you're like, oh yeah, that works actually a lot better than when you're trying to use absolutely every tool in like one story.
Oh my God. I'm thinking of that marker colored version of the Harley Quinn comic. Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
Mad Love, right? Mad
Yeah.
Love, where like Bruce Timm like colored the whole thing in marker
Yeah.
and gave it to the color coder to be
And
like,
the
okay,
color
now give us
coder
a pretty
did
gradient scheme.
gradients on gradients on more gradients on something that's drawn in a like a
Tune.
yeah, 2D animation style. I'd forgotten about that marker comic. That's so important. I gotta keep that in
Sorry.
mind. As
It's like
someone who colors comics with markers, there was this other comic that was colored with markers, which was never published.
yeah. Well, whoever used the computer to color this, they did a good job.
I'm assuming it's for Maida. We don't have, I mean, I
I
guess
think
I'll know
so.
that for sure, but I don't think
I'm
anyone else has given credit.
fairly confident, but yeah.
I'm scrubbing back to the credits or the beginning to see if there's any other credits, but yeah, I think.
Nope. And given that it's pretty consistently, I mean, it's different, a different palette from her other work. It's like the approach is the same, so I am assuming it's her.
Yeah. Oh, here it is. My Aunt is a Monster was conceptualized in a Moleskine notebook. Sketched and penciled using Procreate on an iPad Pro and then colored and finished in Photoshop. It was lettered in the author's hand. So
I
there
don't
you
know
go.
whether that means it's hand lettered or lettered in a font based on her
I
handwriting.
think that means it's a font based on the author's
That's what it
handwriting.
looks like.
Yeah. I think if you're going to go as specific as like conceptualized in a moleskin, then you would say whether it
We
was
would
hand
have heard
lettered.
about a colorist if there was a colorist.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
Yes.
yeah. We're told whose traditional land it was done on as well. So
Yeah.
you don't acknowledge the land you're on and not acknowledge the colorist, I think.
My God, what a
Please.
burn.
Sure. That would, oh yeah, if you were the colorist and it was told like whose traditional territory your book was made on and then your name was left out of it, that would be
New
that
low.
would be some drama.
Yeah. Oh,
All
man.
right, I think we're out of time. Any final thoughts?
I really like this book. I think I might pick up a physical copy for my nephew. Yeah, great recommendation, John. A lot of fun to read. I'm gonna put money on My Aunt is a Monster Volume 2.
I would love for there to be a volume 2. Like anything that Romina does is going to be good though, so no pressure.
Yeah, I'll take any book from Romina. I'm not picky. But I would recommend this to a younger reader. I think it brings a lot to the YA genre that we don't see. So I think any YA reader that is voracious in reading comics would enjoy this. For older readers who aren't necessarily interested in comics, it might feel a little kiddie. But for older readers who are fans of comics, there's a lot to appreciate and enjoy.
And my final thoughts are going to be also my shout out because I want to shout out this Alexander book. So it's Alexander, the Servant and the Water of Life. Book one is out via a Kickstarter and also published by Hiveworks. And it is such a nice book. It's like beautiful cover and great art. I love the story. I love the premise of it. She's basically So, like Alexander the Great, obviously a real historical person. We have a lot of historical information about him. But there's also, because he was so famous in life, there are also all these legends about him. And so this book is taking some of those legends and like retelling them, but not telling them exactly in the original form, because this is Romana's own take on those legends. And I really like it. I enjoy it a lot.
I'm Jam. I'd like to shout out another former TradeWaiter pick. So in the past, we've read Evan Dam's Fatu. Evan Dam is now writing a comic called Third Voice, and I think it's really interesting. I think it's his best work to date, and I really recommend it. I think there's already over 200 pages of it or something. So don't sleep on it, or he'll race past you, and then you'll be like 800 pages behind again.
I was reading that on Webtoon when it first came out, and now I'm definitely 800 pages behind. Reading it was good. I'm gonna keep shouting out things I picked up at TCAF. So I picked up an anthology, as I am off to do. This one's called Kaleidoscope, and it's by the Fruit Salad Comics Collective. And Fruit Salad is apparently another up-and-coming Canadian Comics Collective, and
Aren't they local? Aren't they from Vancouver? Because they were at VanCAF too.
so the main organizer's from Vancouver, but I get the impression that their creators are not necessarily all from Vancouver.
Okay.
But the anthology's got a color theme, so every chapter has a color, and the art has black and one color used by the artist to different effect.
That's fun.
And it's just a little short anthology. Really liked it, and I love anthologies. I love comic collectives, and I'm going to shout out a new up and coming collective that put out a new anthology book because that's the right thing to do.
What's our next book going to be?
Our next book will be The Jellyfish by Boom.
The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. Thanks to Sleuth for the music. You can find us wherever there are podcasts. If there are podcasts, there's probably our podcast. You should find it and listen to our many, many episodes.
If there are no podcasts, something's gone horribly wrong.
How do you live without podcasts? I don't know how I would get anything drawn without podcasts.
Oh my God, I don't know how to live.